Iran says it's seriously following up the case of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani and won't let those behind it go unpunished. Lebanon's Hezbollah dismisses Israeli threats to target its missile production facility, saying the group has the ability to strike anywhere in Israel. China calls on the U.S. to stop using the Hong Kong issue to interfere in its domestic affairs. This following Washington's reaction to a trial of a group of fugitive Hong Kongers. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Sajafik. Good to have you with us. Starting with the top story, Iran saying it will not let those behind the assassination of General Soleimani go unpunished. Foreign Ministry spokesman says that Iran is seriously pursuing the case of the general's killing through legal and domestic channels. Said Khatibzadeh underlined the role of the martyr general in fighting terrorism and establishing security and peace in the region. Said that Soleimani was a pillar of regional balance who sacrificed his life in the fight against extremism. General Soleimani was assassinated in January by the U.S. during a visit to Iraq. The Iranian central city of Qom is hosting a gathering of members of resistance movements ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani. Resistance activists and scholars have gotten together to pay tribute to the martyr general and his cause. A guest from Pakistan, Sajjad Kazemi, says that the general was the true hero of the fight against terrorism.
Alhamdulillah, it's a great opportunity for us to be here, and we are paying our tributes to these two great leader of resistance, General Qasem Soleimani, martyred Qasem Soleimani, and as well as Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas. The real war which fought against the Daesh and all those elements which spread terrorism not in Middle East but in the other part of the world too. So the hero of that fight is really General Qasem Soleimani and all the person like this.
The first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon is just around the corner. Our correspondents in Pakistan, Indian control, and Kashmir have talked to the people about their opinions regarding Iran's Lieutenant General Soleimani.
General Soleimani was a brave man. He was a symbol against capitalization, not only in Iran, also for all the countries in the region.
Look who was General Qasem Soleimani. He was fighting against Daesh, a proxy of international establishment, you can say Americans. And Americans who were supposed to call Daesh a terrorist, and instead of fighting against Daesh, they were fighting against General Qasem Soleimani.
Jo General Qasem Soleimani the, wo
General Qasem Soleimani was sign of unity among Muslims. He was struggling to unify Muslims, but imperialistic forces like the U.S. and Israel acted against the unity among Muslims. Therefore, they killed him.
General Qasem Soleimani.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only working for the cause of Shia communities of the world, but in fact, he was working for the entire Muslim Ummah. That is why he emerged as a hero and fearless leader.
The absence of General Soleimani is not being felt by Iranians alone, but by all the oppressed people around the world. General Soleimani was a great revolutionary and a hero beyond the borders. He will always have a special place in the hearts of the oppressed and the poor.
I have closely watched and I have closely read and I have closely followed General Qasem Soleimani for a long time. I personally believe his only school of thought is to help and develop humanity. Let's talk about his school of thought. He precisely believes that if there is a suppression, if there is an oppression anywhere going on around the world, be it any part of the world, leave it, whether it's a Muslim nation, non-Muslim nation, it's anywhere, he is trying to oppose that.
His assassination has deeply affected the Middle East, not only Middle East, in fact it has affected the whole world politics.
Generally, when such high-profile assassinations are carried out, the countries do not take credit for the assassinations, but the manner in which the United States of America took credit of eliminating General Qasem Soleimani, it tells us that he has been a high-value target for them. His killing has been, you know, a high-profile killing, and also tells us about the stature of that, you know, person, military person, who is also credited of, you know, trying to forge unity and trying to forge a partnership between the Muslim, you know, powerful leaders in the Muslim world.
In other news, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that Israel's efforts to prevent the group from obtaining precision-guided missiles have failed. Said Hassan Nasrallah says that Hezbollah has twice as many precision-guided missiles as it had a year ago. He dismissed the Israeli threats to target a Hezbollah facility in the eastern Bekaa region. Nasrallah warned that the resistance movement is capable of striking any location in Israel in retaliation. The Secretary General made those comments in an interview with Lebanon's Al Mayadeen television. Political commentator Hadi Al-Kabaisi says that Nasrallah's statement about Hezbollah's missile power has nullified the Israeli regime's claims about stopping the movement's missile program.
I think this statement from Said Hassan changed the game between Lebanon and the Zionist state. Because the Zionists said that we are making a battle between the wars to stop the fueling or the build-up of the guided missiles, a precise guided missile to Lebanon, from 5 years till now. And they told their people in Israel that they succeeded in this operation. And they said also that the precise guided missiles in the hands of Hezbollah means threat and a strategic threat for the Israeli state. So today we have a new reality in the struggle or in the battle between Lebanon and Israel. We have a new reality that Lebanon possesses this a large number of guided missiles, and he making a new statement of deterrence against Israel. And now we are waiting for the commentators or the policy makers in Israel to wait what will say about this new reality.
Hundreds of Syrian refugees have fled a makeshift camp in northern Lebanon after a dispute led a group of Lebanese youths to set fire to the tents. The fire destroyed shelters of some 75 families in the Minia region near Tripoli, forcing some 400 refugees to leave. According to Lebanese media, at least three people were wounded in a clash that took place on Saturday night. The reason behind the dispute remains unknown. Lebanon has seen a rise in tensions between Syrian refugees and locals recently. Lebanon has more than 1 million Syrian refugees who have fled their country since the beginning of the conflict there in 2011. The only center for treating children with leukemia in Yemen is suffering from a lack of medicines and supplies, causing an increase in fatality rates by up to 50%. And that is while international and relief organizations have failed to do their part to save children's lives. Abu Latif al-Washali reports.
More and more Yemeni civilians die in Yemen on a daily basis amid the continuation of the Saudi siege on the Arab country. Here in the Pediatric Leukemia Treatment Center, 50% of patients, namely children, die due to the lack of medicine and medical care they need to survive.
We've suffered a lot to establish this center so that children could have a chance to survive, especially due to the difficulties of traveling abroad. During the past 6 years, we received hundreds of cases, but the death rate is still high. And we hope that the concerned international organizations will do their role so the children could have a normal recovery.
Hundreds of children come to the center from all across Yemen, as it is the only medical center for such patients, hoping that they will receive the required treatment. However, the ongoing war and the crippling blockade have made the center suffer from a permanent shortage of medicines, medical supplies, and radiation devices.
The families of patients come from remote areas. They also face lack of medical supplies. Also, the treatment for leukemia is marrow transplantation, which is very expensive and is carried out outside the country, which is not possible due to the continued siege and the closure of San Jose Airport.
I come from Al-Mahwit Governorate, which is very far away, and we face a lot of trouble traveling to reach this center, which suffers from a constant shortage of medicines and overcrowding of patients, as it is the only center in Yemen.
The health sector in Yemen is in a dire need of necessary support from international and relief organizations, which have not played their role in alleviating the suffering of the Yemeni people that began in March 2015 due to the Saudi war on Yemen.
Hundreds of children lose their lives at the gates of the center due to the lack of medicines and other medical supplies, as well as their inability to travel for treatment due to its high costs and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
China has again called on the U.S. to stop using the Hong Kong issue to interfere in its domestic affairs. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian says that Beijing is firmly opposed to any remarks by Washington that disregard facts. He was reacting to a statement from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing that called for the release of a dozen Hong Kongers on trial in Shenzhen. The statement said that their crime was to flee tyranny. Hong Kong has become another contentious issue between China and the U.S., whose relations were already strained over trade, Taiwan, and the South China Sea, among others. Washington has imposed sanctions on several current and former Hong Kong officials over a security law. China has long blamed the U.S. for stoking tensions in Hong Kong by siding with anti-government protesters there. U.S. President Donald Trump has signed a $2.3 trillion bill that includes a $900 billion COVID relief package into law, and this came after days of stalling and criticizing the legislation. The signing averts a Tuesday government shutdown, restoring unemployment benefits to millions of Americans. It clears the way for $600 stimulus checks as well. The Senate and the House passed the bill last week, but Trump described it as wasteful and unnecessary. The president threatened to would not sign unless the individual relief checks are tripled in amount. House Democrats, who have long favored $2,000 payments to struggling Americans, are to hold a vote on his proposal on Monday. The measure is expected to fail as many Republicans oppose it. The U.S. is the world's worst hit country by the pandemic, with more than 19.1 million cases and 330,000 fatalities. Now in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell says that the government's $600 stimulus checks aren't sufficient for the people in need, but they can at least postpone the eviction process for many Americans.
It only provides $600 for those who are in need. Think about that. If you are paying a mortgage, rent, you need food, that's already burned up within the first half of the month, never mind a full month of needing additional money to pay off bills. But it also postpones the eviction process for many people as well. There are a lot of things in this bill that the president said he disagreed with, but then there are a lot of reasons why he should have signed it. Will Congress take up another measure to provide additional aid for Americans who really need it? Everybody is in agreement that $600 is not much, but it's still more than $0. And I think that's the overall point that members of Congress were trying to make to the president when he was reluctant to sign the bill. Now, there are those who believe that the president initially rejected it and wanted to call for more money to seem as more of a populist, to seem that he was fighting for the American people. However, there were those who disagreed with the president's process in doing all this, especially in light of more than 300,000 Americans dying to COVID-19. Remember, a virus that the president initially called a hoax, one that he was very slow to react to and respond to. So many believe that, hey, if the president had acted a lot sooner, more lives would have been saved. So if he really was acting in the interests of American people, he would have been more responsive and quicker acting when it came to COVID-19.
Well, let's take a look at South Korea. The country has detected its first three cases of the new COVID-19 variant that just recently emerged in the UK. Health authorities saying that the three are members of a London-based family who just came back. They were placed in quarantine. South Korea is the latest country reporting cases of the new variant that is said to be more contagious. The virus has been detected in several European countries, as well as in Canada, Jordan, and Japan. More than 50 countries have suspended flights to and from the UK. Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang says that a mutant strain of the virus is complicating things in South Korea, and the government's efforts to contain the outbreak have become ineffective.
This mutant strain is complicating things because this is 70% more contagious than ordinary strains or other mutant strains, variants that have been found in the United Kingdom in the past. It could be up to 70% more contagious. And that means that South Korea is in real big trouble right now. The epicenter is Greater Seoul. The majority of the cases that are popping up daily at such an unprecedented rate are here in Greater Seoul, the most vital area of the country. And so now the South Korean government on January 3rd will have to rethink whether it wants to indeed go forward with not imposing a lockdown. This has not been working. Despite all their contact tracing, and they have served as a global model in this, their social distancing measures and contact tracing are no longer working. And things are out of control here. There are container beds being set up outside of hospitals for older patients and other critical care COVID-19 patients who need intensive care unit beds. But even those are not enough to meet the demand. And so the death rate here is also soaring.
Now, take a look at Europe. Austria has started a nationwide COVID vaccination program prioritizing nursing homes, healthcare personnel, and frontline workers. Up to 10,000 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine entered the country on Saturday. Officials saying the country will receive more than 4 million doses by this summer. Omaleski has more.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first five volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included three elderly patients with underlying health conditions and two healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the two doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in three phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its third hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a third corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe. Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
Another matter is about moral education. Of course, according to today's reports and the reports delivered to me from various places, good tasks have been carried out in our academies in terms of religious, ideological, and moral orientations, but I wish to focus on moral education above all. Our academies should pay more attention to this matter. We should polish our dear youth's inner selves. The youth gathering together here are my dear children. They are the pure souls of our society. They are among our best people in our society. Therefore, we should provide the means to polish them as much as we can. Their spiritual deployment lies in piety, sincerity, courage, humility, and commitment to one's pledge and promise to the system, to Islam, and to the revolution. This constitutes their spiritual deployment, and they are the most important elements in this regard.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
This is not particular to the youth in the armed forces. All young forces of the country, and most importantly, the working on the path, the revolutionary forces of the country, the forces which consider themselves to be working on the path of the revolution, religiousness and piety, as this is really the case, should pay attention to these commitments. It should not be the case that if a youth of ours undertakes the responsibility, he should try to pin his hopes on an important position and on gaining money and trifles. Youth should work in a sincere manner, as they did during the sacred defense era. Those who made sacrifices during the sacred defense era managed to make achievements with purity and spirit of self-sacrifice. And this has been the case ever since. Running after worldly trifles disrupts one's work. If there are some individuals who do tasks with the purpose of achieving worldly goals, gaining financial rewards, and winning worldly positions, then our affairs will not move forward. It is with endeavor and purity that affairs will move forward.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
survive.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkili said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in a war.
The United Nations, of course, has this endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran,
and Tehran in return will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance and action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. President-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is the last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a U.S. company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the U.S. fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime
and the ending of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed. And after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again. The one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems. The United States has spent the last two decades fighting an endless and unwinnable war in Afghanistan, with the conflict costing the US billions each year, as well as the loss of life on both sides, reminding us all of the embarrassing defeat suffered by the US in Vietnam. But with the US slowly outstaying its welcome in West and Central Asia, as demonstrated by the Iraqi parliament voting to oust them, it seems that Washington is intent on leaving a lasting legacy in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. A secret CIA-trained hit squad known as Zero One has been trained in Afghanistan, with evidence suggesting that the group, who operated under the cover of darkness, are responsible for a series of extrajudicial killings and executions across the country, and most worryingly of all, against civilians. Reports from numerous eyewitnesses and survivors suggest that as many as 51 innocent civilians have been killed, with the youngest amongst them being only 8 years old, as the terror group targets schools, medical centres, and other various institutions. With the raids apparently taking place across four districts in Afghanistan, and with most of the victims having no links to the Taliban, the question arises as to whether there's some kind of partnership between the CIA-trained operatives and the Taliban. According to multiple reports, the US has broken multiple rules of war, breached human rights, and has failed to deliver on any of the promises it made when it comes to building a secure Afghanistan. This raises the question as to just how the US can genuinely justify their presence in the country with so many operational failures in place.
The problem, we're talking about the US presence in Afghanistan and what we call in this country collateral damage, is that there is no justification at this point after 18 years. We invaded Afghanistan allegedly to go after the Osama bin Laden, who it turns out was probably hiding in Pakistan. There was no way the Afghanistani government could accede to the demands that President Bush made when he made them in 2001. the justification is just not there. Now, after 18 years...
With attacks such as those completed by the Zero One unit, one official from the Afghan intelligence agency has stated that Americans have always been present during the Zero One raids. But the official failed to distinguish between the blurred lines as to whether the unit were special forces, task forces, or quite simply, CIA agents. What's clear is that the US has a very shadowy modus operandi, and this is something that seems to allow them to get away with the murder of civilians in the process. With pressure mounting on the US to leave Afghanistan and Iraq, could training such groups by the CIA and US forces guarantee a proxy unit for the US military in the area once they'd left? We know from the past that the CIA has a long history of interfering in various sovereign states, and in particular are keen to arm certain groups to the teeth in order to either justify their presence in an area or quite simply allow splinter groups to carry out the dirty work on behalf of Washington and Langley. In fact, when one looks into the money involved in performing such tasks, the figures are quite boggling, with the CIA allocating some $2.5 billion of their budget to covert operations alone, a sum that equates to around 5% of the total intelligence purse. But when some of the groups backed by the CIA are actually fighting back against the US, including killing its military personnel in the area, does this not create a notion of double jeopardy for the US, showing just how desperate they are when it comes to maintaining a foothold in places such as Afghanistan?
It's a question of desperation. The Trump administration met with the Taliban about a year ago or 2 years ago, as far as we can tell, and basically said, if you stop killing Americans, then we can get out of here, basically. We don't care who else you're killing, but don't kill us. And we can work something out, but if you're killing us and killing our troops, then we're never going to be able to withdraw from here, because we're not going to withdraw under fire. That's basically the United States position.
There may be many similar cases around the world that have yet to come to light. This report, however, has finally exposed the CIA as the main funding party behind the execution of civilians. What remains to be seen is whether such groups will remain US proxies in the future and continue to allow the US to carry out a series of illegal operations, all whilst being able to deny being present at the time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with clergy and the students of the seminary. Allah the Almighty in chapter 2 of the Holy Quran, verse 257 says, Allah is the guardian or wali of those who believe. He brings them out of the darkness into the light. He whose guardian or wali is Allah the Blessed and Exalted, and who is taken by him out from the darkness never commits another sin, never backbites, never slanders others, and he is never vengeful or envious of his brothers in faith. His own heart is filled with a feeling of luminosity, and he no longer holds the world or what it contains in high esteem.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another episode of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini, and I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Imam Khomeini has said in his one of speeches that right now we are all put under tests and trials. So we need to apply this saying in our life, that every one of us, even at this moment that I'm talking and you're listening to this program, we all are put under test and trial. And obviously in the Quran, if we want to see, we can see chapter 2, verse number 155, in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ وَالْجُوعِ وَنَقْصٍ مِّنَ الْأَمْوَالِ وَالْأَنفُسِ وَالثَّمَرَاتِ وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ. Allah says in chapter 2, verse 155, that we have put you in the trial. We are testing you for everything.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
We will try you with something of fear. Khawf is fear. And hunger, and loss of wealth, and lives, and fruits of toil, but give good tidings to those who patiently preserve. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has clearly said this in Quran, that remember that we will try you with the fear, maybe the fear of not having a good job, maybe the fear of not having a good future, maybe having a fear of anything at any time. Maybe he can have with the jur. Jur is hunger. Sometimes, you know, we had a hard time. Some of us who eat only one time meal because they don't have that much money. Some of us have, for example, they eat for two times. Some of us have, they're wealthy, so they eat three times. But still, Allah is saying, we will either try you with the khawf, with the hunger, and by the loss in the wealth. So may Allah give us tawfiq to have patience in our life and to understand these things, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every night.
economic divide.
Tension between Greece and Turkey dates back to the Ottoman era, with both nations seeing a roller coaster relationship of ups and downs, which at their peak saw the countries locked in a conflict on four major occasions. With the recent Turkish decision to explore the Eastern Mediterranean Sea for, quote, scientific purposes, but more likely to explore natural resources, the Greek reaction has been one of protest, with the Greek prime minister stating that Turkey's actions broke international law.
Leave no doubt, Turkey's actions undermine international law and threaten the security and stability of the broader region of the Eastern Mediterranean and of all EU member states. The European Union made it absolutely clear that unilateral actions will not be left unanswered when they threaten sovereign rights of member states.
Now, Turkey, on the other hand, disputes the Greek claims with the Turkish president. He has stated that Turkey, in this case, will always act to protect its legitimate interests in the Eastern Mediterranean, be it in the field of exploration to the protection of Turkish interests in northern Cyprus. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Afwayi. In this week's episode, we will be looking into the tension between Turkey and Greece in the Eastern Mediterranean and examine what the economic impact may be on the two nations. Okay, the agency in the Eastern Mediterranean is the key sticking point when it comes to the tensions. Now, back in 1932, the Lausanne Peace Treaty attempted to establish a political balance between the two states, which, all in all, both parties adhered to in most aspects, with the main aim of the treaty establishing maritime borders and sovereignty. Under international maritime law, current conditions see the Greek 6 miles limit, comprised of approximately 43.5% of the agency, whilst the same rule applied for Turkey, only seeing the nation claim rights to 7.5% of the sea. The remaining 49% is considered international waters, or the high sea. So what does it all come down to? Well, put it simply, oil and gas. The U.S. Geological Survey estimated that back in 2010, there were around 1.7 billion barrels of recoverable oil and around 3.5 trillion cubic meters of recoverable natural gas to be found in the Eastern Mediterranean's Levant Basin province. That's a plot that lays largely around the island of Cyprus itself, which is a contentious topic between Greece and Turkey.
Turkey and Greece have long clashed in the region, dating back from the Ottoman Empire, with the remnants of the past still causing tension today. The Eastern Mediterranean in particular has caused no end of diplomatic and military spats between the two states, with the Turkish role in northern Cyprus being one of the hottest topics of contention between Athens and Ankara.
We're here today especially due to the new provocation of Turkey to, in violation of Security Council resolutions. The people of Cyprus and especially the youth will not forget and will keep fighting and struggling for the restoration of our human rights and until we return to all our homeland.
But it seems that the main sticking point today is a war of words arising from what lies beneath the Aegean Sea, an area particularly contested between the two states, as both lay claim to disputed territorial waters, as well as the resources that go with them. Turkey have recently started so-called scientific and seismic explorations of the Aegean Sea, something that Greece claims is a breach of international maritime law, as the waters being prospected, according to Greece, belong to them. Yet under the banner of science, it seems the true intention of the Turkish exploration ship is to scope out and find oil and gas resources, of which it seems the subaquatic terrain of the Aegean may hold a valuable deposit of the much sought-after commodities. With both nations laying claim to the area, a host of maps and charts have emerged stating which country owns what. However, neither of them can agree on fixed details, suggesting that the tension caused by the Turkish exploration could lead to an ongoing war of words, a date at the ICJ Court of Arbitration, or worse yet, a conflict between the two nations, something that both have seen in the past. It seems then that the idyllic Eastern Mediterranean, with its host of tourist resorts, sublime clear waters and lush beaches, could see things turn very sour for the local area and economy, unless something is done fast.
So, why is oil and gas such a priority for Turkey and Greece? It may therefore be useful to consider how much each nation already has before considering just why they want more. Now, starting with Turkey, it currently holds some 312 million barrels of proven oil reserves as of the year 2016, making it the 53rd largest oil producing nation in the world. However, Turkey is a nation highly dependent on oil, consuming nearly 942,000 barrels per day, a daily deficit of minus 875,500 barrels. Now, moving on to Greece, estimates suggest that it is home to around 10 million barrels of proven oil reserves, ranking the Hellenic Republic 90th in the world oil-producing nations. Much like Turkey, the demand for Greece is higher than the production, with daily consumption at 296,000 barrels per day, leaving a deficit of 280,000 barrels.
In terms of geographical positioning, Turkey and Greece sit on the borderline between Europe and Asia, making the area one of the most important geopolitical bridges in the world. Greece, for its part, enjoys being a member of the 27-bloc European Union, bringing with it a wealth of advantages from free trade, economic ties, and of course the comfort of knowing that the EU financial powerhouse is on hand to back up the vaults if needed, something that the Greeks have turned to in the past. Turkey, however, have been knocking on the door at Brussels now for decades, trying to get the EU to accept their membership into the bloc, something that has yet to materialise for the Turks. There are, of course, multiple sticking points when it comes to the Turks getting into the EU, with the likes of human rights issues and cultural issues, to name just a couple. However, Turkey and the EU also have a difficult situation to deal with in terms of the migrant crisis, something that the Greeks also play a part in. With the Greeks struggling to control their borders from the influx of migrants, including reports of live fire being aimed at people, for some reason, the EU is pointing the finger of blame at Turkey, suggesting they need to do more when it comes to controlling migration routes.
The idea is that we are ready to cooperate with Turkey. What we are doing, and we are ready to cooperate more with Turkey in order to tackle this difficult challenge of migration. And of course, it's important for all the member states, all the European member states, it's important for them to have a good and a strong and responsible cooperation with Turkey.
Leaders in the EU are also sceptical about the recent actions of the Turks in the Eastern Mediterranean, with French President Emmanuel Macron, for one, showing his distaste at so-called Turkish provocations. With the current tension yet to be resolved between Turkey and Greece, as well as a host of other issues underlying deep in the relationship between Turkey and the EU, it seems that a lot is yet to be achieved before the Turkish flag is raised outside the EU Commission in Brussels.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dimitris Papadimitriou, professor of political science from the University of Manchester. Now, he's the director of the Manchester Jean Monnet Center of Excellence and has numerous publications on various EU and Greek affairs. Professor, many thanks for being with us here on Economic